I've always been and will always be a writer primarily. That's where my creativity manifests. In fact, it's lucky, I think, to have one special meaning container, one special discipline, one place you love above all others. I work with lots of clients who love 23 things and have trouble working in any of them because they're not sure if they're a dancer today or a visual artist today or a poet today. So for me, I think it's quite a blessing to know that I'm a writer and that's what I do primarily.
From reading your book, I would say that you see the art medium as a tool for growth and healing.
Absolutely. I think it's one of our primary meaning containers. That's the way I think of it. Since we are obliged to make our own meaning, we have to figure out what feels meaningful to us. And there are only a handful of things that feel genuinely meaningful to human beings, I believe. One are relationship kinds of things, being in love, being compassionate, taking care of people, being of service. And another is having the experience of manifesting our potential, having the experience of making use of those thoughts and feelings that are within us. So since that does feel meaningful to us, if we aren't doing it, we have the experience of meaninglessness and existential depression will follow, and it doesn't feel good. So it's important that we manifest our creativity for our own emotional life.
Welcome to Living on Purpose. Eric Maisel, I am so happy for you to be my guest. How are you doing today?
Great to be with you.
And where are you right now while we're speaking?
I'm in San Francisco, just home from doing some workshops in Taos, New Mexico.
Now, you do these workshops quite often with your work. In fact, I was looking at your website, which is simply ericmaisel.com. That's ericmaisel.com. And I saw that you had done a workshop in Edmonton, in Canada.
That's right. Actually, I've done a few in Edmonton because a pair of creativity coaches I trained live there, and they're active in that community, and they've invited me to come. And typically, I only go where I'm invited. I'm busy enough that I don't quite set up my own workshops nowadays. So I go to famous places like Paris and slightly less famous places like Edmonton.
I'm on Vancouver Island in Canada, so I'm familiar with the Edmonton area as well in this country, so that's great. Now, just to fill in for the listeners here, that you have a background in philosophy and psychology, counseling, and creative writing. And from what I also read on your website, it looks like you used to be active as a marriage and family therapist, but you're more focused on writing and doing workshops now, I understand.
That and the creativity coaching. I started out as a therapist 25 years ago now, worked with creative and performing artists exclusively, and then about 10 years into that, wanted to get out of the medical model, out of therapy, and continue working with the same people, but on different aspects of their issues and problems. So I've been doing the creativity coaching for the last 15 years or so. In that same period, I've done about 15 or 20 books about different aspects of the creative process and the creative personality. Between the writing and the workshops and the creativity coaching, I'm hopping.
Well, it sounds like, and I was really pleased to have you come to my attention and to the attention of Living on Purpose here with this new book, Creativity for Life, Practical Advice on the Artist Personality and Career from America's Foremost Creativity Coach. And this was sent to me by the publisher of the book, New World Library. It's quite an epic book, and I think from what you say here, you've pulled it together from a couple of earlier books that you'd written?
Well, for one earlier book, which had two different incarnations.
Oh, right.
It was called Staying Sane in the Arts in 1992. It came out the same season as Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way.
Oh, yeah.
Both of us started this field, let's say, if it's a field, about that year, 1992. Then when it came out in its paperback version, it came out as A Life in the Arts. And now I've updated it with about, 40% new material. And so now it has this incarnation.
Creativity coach is a new term. I mean, there's a lot of different coaches. People are familiar with them with sports and life coach and business coach, but this is actually the first I've heard of a creativity coach.
Yeah, it's becoming slightly better known. If you Google it, you'll now get 60 or 70 or 80,000 hits, whereas 2 or 3 years ago, you might have gotten 4 hits. There's now a Creativity Coaching Association. I've trained probably 500 or 600 creativity coaches over the last 5 or 6 years. It's beginning to get some name recognition and some cachet, and it's beginning to look like it might be a viable profession down the road. So there probably are, I would imagine, 1,000 or so people who represent themselves as creativity coaches nowadays and who are working either via email or phone or in person or in group settings with creative clients.
Why would a person solicit the assistance of a creativity coach?
First of all, most creative people don't have much support in their life. And even if they have one kind of support, they often don't have support for their creative life specifically. So it's a way of getting support. It's also a way of being held accountable. If you want to hold yourself accountable, if you have trouble with discipline, with getting your work done, whether you call it blockage or resistance or something else, one of the things a creativity coach does is hold you accountable. So it's really the twin pillars of support and accountability. And then there are all of the practical, strategic things that a creativity coach knows to help you with respect to your career, with respect to the marketplace, with respect to getting particular projects done. So you might hire that person on just as you would hire on any coach who has some special knowledge in an area.
You are a creativity coach. Are you particularly creative in any other field besides writing and coaching?
I wouldn't say so. I had a little mini visual art career. I worked in pastels. I had shows, but that's on a back burner, a way back burner. In fact, that's off the stove, I would say, at this point. I've always been and will always be a writer primarily. That's where my creativity manifests. In fact, it's lucky, I think, to have one special meaning container, one special discipline, one place you love above all others. I work with lots of clients who love 23 things and have trouble working in any of them because they're not sure if they're a dancer today or a visual artist today or a poet today. So for me, I think it's quite a blessing to know that I'm a writer and that's what I do primarily.
Well, I remember when I was younger being quite impressed that Joni Mitchell, for example, at that time had an album with a self-portrait that she'd painted on the cover. Do you remember that?
I do, in fact, yes. And I think I'm of that era.
Yes, I think you're about 10 years older than me. And I remember at the time, I can still picture holding it in my basement of my home and being really intrigued by the fact that she could be a singer and a painter.
Many clients, my clients, have those various loves, but it's hard to integrate those loves. It's hard to come to the place where you get an album and can do the self-portrait on that album. For most people, it's rather a fractured thing, and they have trouble doing any of them because it is so fractured. So I think maybe it's unfortunate that sometimes we come upon somebody who's integrated it all, and we think we get to do that. For most people, it's a little more disintegrated.
Is it a matter of commitment?
It's a matter of a variety of things. I think you have to make a decision as to what your primary meaning container is, what your primary discipline is. I'm sure for Joni Mitchell it was singing and songwriting. You need to know that, so you need to know what you're working on first thing each day, so to speak, both literally and metaphorically. If you do that, if you can have the habit of working on your primary discipline 7 days a week, then you have the chance of adding on a second thing and a third thing. But if you don't have that first habit in place, if you don't have that good creativity practice where you know exactly what you're working on each day, then it's not a blessing to love many things, and then it's more likely that you won't get any of them done.
Now, Eric, I'm wondering what you say to someone who says to you, I don't have an artistic bone in my body.
I hear that in a variety of different ways. Sometimes it's I have no good ideas, or I'd love to write a novel, but I don't have a novel in me, or and the way I typically reply is that it's probably that your mind is too noisy for you to even know if you have any creative thoughts. For me, the biggest problem that creative people face is what Buddhists call monkey mind. That is, we're thinking too many small things all day long. It's getting worse and worse, 4,000 email followed by 6,000 something else. And then we have all of the basic responsibilities of picking up the kids at 3 and figuring out what dinner is. We're holding so many of these small thoughts that it's really difficult to even know if we have any creative thoughts. So when a person says they're not creative or they don't have a good idea or something in the same vein, my response to them is you have to figure out how to get your mind less noisy. I have plenty of tactics for that. I did a whole book called 10 Zen Seconds, which is about how to use breathing and cognitive techniques to quiet your mind so that finally you might have the thoughts you've always meant to have. So I don't take that as ruination. When someone says, I don't have a creative bone in my body, I don't believe it. I don't take it to mean that they are ruined. All I take it to mean is that their mind is too noisy for them to even know if they have any ideas.
Okay, so then you would say that everyone is creative.
Part of that is how you define creativity. There are several different kinds of definitions. In the business world, it tends to mean innovation and problem solving, and it's usually bottom line driven. There are lots of different meanings. My meaning is the old-fashioned meaning from the 50s, 60s, and 70s of realizing human potential. I think all creativity means, it's just another way of saying, realizing your own potential. Since everyone has some measure of potential, I would say that everyone's creative. I think it's just a simple, logical thing that if it's about realizing potential, everyone has some potential.
What is an artist then?
Typically someone who is in love with a particular discipline, works in that discipline, is willing to be an apprentice in that discipline over time, has an easier time of going into don't know and going into mystery and making mistakes and messes, probably has the kind of personality with a little bit more stubbornness, a little bit more nonconformity. In other words, we could say many things about what it is. I don't believe it's one thing. But if it's any one thing, it's really just spending more time with a discipline than the average person does. If you're a visual artist, it's going to museums and actually painting and actually thinking about your paintings, etc.
People are generally sensitive, but they don't always channel their sensitivity through art, do they?
Mm-hmm. They often don't channel it anywhere.
Well, yeah, or they do it in a destructive way. So creativity is more productive.
It is.
Yeah. How do you help people, for example, who have the proverbial creative writer's block? What would you suggest?
Well, the first thing is I want to know what they think they're writing about. In order to have a writer's block, you have to have had a project in mind.
Uh-huh.
Or else you're not even blocked yet.
Right.
You don't know what you're working on.
Yeah, give it time.
Yeah. So I need to hear, you know, what their novel's about. And in the telling, when a client will tell me, well, my novel's about X, Y, and Z, I usually begin to hear what the problems might be. The problem might be that the person is trying to write a novel about two people who are divorcing, but clearly hasn't worked through her own divorce yet and really doesn't want to write about the subject matter. So for that person, I might have to suggest that another book needs to come before the divorce book. In other words, it's situational, it's personal, and I need to hear from the person what they're attempting to write so that in the recitation I begin to hear what the solutions might be.
Yeah, you can take clues from how they're expressing it, right?
Exactly. It might be about the work. The problem might be in the work. The problem might be in some personality piece that I'm hearing, you know, as they speak. The problem may be marketplace stuff. They may have done three novels before, none of them sold, and now they're pretty disappointed. They just don't believe that their fourth one has any chance. So then we're really working on a kind of depression work or a kind of disappointment work. So it really depends on what the person's presenting.
In your book here, Creativity for Life, you definitely, you get right to the heart of the matter from a wide variety of angles, looking at what the underlying issues and fears, anxieties, you're not messing around with this book, and you have some really poignant questions for self-reflection. In fact, it's been a bit of an emotional ride for me preparing for this interview, looking again through these questions, and obviously reading them closely enough to reflect. And
that's right.
Right now, I haven't had fully enough time to integrate a lot of these questions, but they have definitely touched me on a lot of different levels. And I think that the work that you're doing would be very helpful.
Yeah, I spent the past weekend in Taos doing a workshop for 20 people. And the basic issues there are they're the biggies. They're the big issues, a lack of self-confidence, a lack of belief in the fact that the work you're doing matters, lack of belief in the fact that you matter. You know, these are very basic existential and psychological issues.
Yeah.
There's nothing, you know, sort of smiley-faced and Pollyannish about what I do. I need people to recognize that they make their own meaning, that they have to hunker down and make choices and decide what they want to work on, decide whether they are going to feel like they matter to themselves.
And also when we're making changes, there's so much risk involved. There's a vision, there's an intention, there's goal setting.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, like right now, like I mentioned to you before our conversation here, that I've been a volunteer radio broadcaster now into my fourth year. And I am giving the universe and the people I'm doing the shows for till the end of October, until my volunteer battery runs out. That is really feeling scary to me today. I'm putting it to the test.
That's right. And there's a chapter in the book near the end about making transitions.
Right.
That making a transition is a crisis period often. It's an anxiety-provoking period, and you have to think through what it means, and you need strategies for dealing with transitions.
And, Eric, you also have some very powerful suggestions on how to deal with success. You know, a lot of us are constantly in resistance to success, even if we think that's what we want, right?
Absolutely. And a person who doesn't yet have success does not believe that a person who does have success has any problem.
Exactly. They think it's the ticket.
Exactly. But the challenges never change. I did a workshop earlier in the year with 30 of America's best-selling authors. They're exactly the same issues that I would be working on with anybody else. So the issues do not change. And then there's a new set of issues about being asked to both do new work and do the same work.
Yeah.
About topping yourself each time, that no matter how well your last thing did, your next one is supposed to do more. Having now, you know, sycophants and a coterie and people hanging on and having strained and strange relationships with your peers. So there are a ton of things that start to happen when you have success. And actually, in the first year of success, many artists go off the deep end. They don't know how to deal with all of the new things that have come their way. So it's in that first year of new success that a lot of creative people really have to watch out.
Yeah, that's a good point. And like you mentioned about the peers, there's envy, there's competition. There's all kinds of things that you wouldn't necessarily choose. And yet you say that a lot of what's involved with a creative person is a sequence of choices.
That's right. And part of it is also being in charge of your own shadow issues.
Right.
If you had always felt half narcissistic and half grandiose and half arrogant, which is absolutely appropriate because we need those qualities to get on with our work, well, now you have the opportunity to be fully narcissistic and fully arrogant and fully grandiose. And we know, we can just tell when we see certain artists interviewed that they've gone over to the dark side of their personality. They've allowed themselves to be corrupted by success. You know, so we have to watch out for ourselves.
I'm in conversation here with Eric Maisel, and his website is ericmaisel.com. And so it does beg the question then, and as you do explore in Creativity for Life, what is recognition, what is success, and what is doubt? And also, how do we receive feedback? It's one thing to receive criticism, but what about the creative person who is producing really beautiful work but doesn't believe that it's beautiful? I know someone like this. It doesn't matter what kind of compliment or comment or feedback I offer this person, I end up feeling like my comment is shabby because she's not able to receive it.
Right. The headline there is what the Buddha said, namely, you have to get a grip on your own mind. She has to get a grip on her own mind. She needs to, first of all, hear what she says to herself. This is a three-step process that cognitive therapists teach. You have to hear what you say to yourself, then you have to dispute those utterances which don't serve you. If you're saying to yourself, I don't really believe what anybody's saying, or I'm not good enough, or I'm not really talented, or something like that, you have to finally really hear what you're saying, which is an act of courage to notice what you're saying to yourself. Then you have to dispute those utterances that don't make sense to you or that you don't want to continue hearing. And then you need to substitute, this is the third step, then you need to substitute more affirmative language. So for her, it would be her finally noticing that even though people are liking her work, she keeps saying internally, I don't believe this, disputing that, finally saying, I do believe it. I want to believe it. I want to stop not believing it. And then having some new affirmative language like, I'm going to accept success, or I'm going to believe people when they like my work. Nobody can make another person do this work, but that's the job of each artist, is to do this self-coaching and do this kind of cognitive work for themselves.
Great. That's a nice process to describe. I appreciate that. How can people successfully integrate success into their lives?
As I say, I think it's not one thing to do. I think part of it is to announce to yourself that you're going to remain human.
Right.
That nothing has changed from that perspective, that you're a human being before you're an artist, and all of the things that will befall you, positive and negative, still will happen, and that you want to maintain relationships, and you want them to be as, you know, clean and smart as you can make them. There is both creating and relating, and no one can survive, no artist can survive only creating. They get too cold and alienated and isolated, so the whole relationship part needs to be front and center in an artist's mind when success happens. So there are a whole array of things. There isn't one thing to think about. There are just many, many things that you want to think about. And of course, you get in this whirlwind when you are successful, and you never manage to catch up with yourself and do this thinking. So I think that's one of the things that you have to do when success hits. You hear famous artists have to do this all the time. They have to go to their ranch in Montana or something to catch up with themselves, to even have the mind space to think about what's been going on.
Yeah, and the isolation thing is, I was really paying attention to that in your book as well, because you can become a workaholic, and if you don't have a mate or people right around you to kind of monitor or mirror your process, then, as you say, you can get too isolated.
That's right, and often you can't sort of conjure up a mate out of nowhere, but you can sometimes conjure up an art buddy, or at least one other person you respect who respects you, who you can deal with and who can look at your work and keep you on track. And that's one of the things I suggest, is that any artist who's feeling isolated and cold, at least try to figure out how to have one art buddy and maintain that relationship. And it's work to maintain any relationship, but to at least maintain that relationship.
There was a quote in your book here, Albert Camus, "When he is recognized as a talent, the creator's great suffering begins."
And that's what we've been talking about, and creative people tend not to believe that if they're not yet successful, and then when they are successful, they entirely understand it.
There's this whole section that you talk about how to take responsibility for your energy. When you were talking about anxiety, you wrote in your book, "Accept that you are a live wire coursing with electricity."
There are lots of aspects of energy that people typically don't understand. One is that you can generate mental energy in a way different from generating physical energy. We typically understand that if we go to sleep, our physical energy will return, or if we eat a power bar, our physical energy will return. And we analogize to mental energy from the way physical energy works, and it's not an appropriate analogy. The way we get mental energy back best is by falling back in love with our work. It's actually love, or its cognates or its synonyms, like enthusiasm or passion or interest, that regenerates mental energy. If your book is boring you, you're exhausted. And if you remember why it is you loved your book, if you can find that originating impulse or that originating passion, physical energy will return. So these are things that most creative people don't understand well enough. And so they say to themselves, "I'm tired," and they think that they can't be not tired. But they could be not tired and get right on with their work if they could remind themselves that they really love their work, or at least that they're interested in their work.
So, Eric, does it ever get any easier?
I think it does get easier. I mean, when it gets easier, we then, as creative people, set ourselves larger challenges just to make sure it's never too easy.
Right.
I think it gets easier in the sense that if you do maintain a regular creativity practice, if you do your creating first thing each morning, 7 days a week, you at least overcome everyday resistance and certain kinds of blockages, and you at least are getting your work done. So it becomes easier in that sense. Conversely, if you're working on a novel which is having its growing pains, that's always going to be difficult. That's never not going to be difficult. So in one sense, it can get easier as with our lifelong apprenticeship, we learn more craft, we learn more habits, we grow more muscles. It can grow easier in that sense. In the other sense of it ever being really easy, that won't happen.
I remember a little button when I was a child that said, "No one ever said it would be easy."
Yeah, and the existentialists always talked about life as project and ongoing challenge, and that's what I believe. I believe our life is our project. We will never come to a time when we don't have some challenge confronting us.
Now, you apparently show up at the computer, but you must handwrite some things. I'm wondering if you're right-handed or left-handed.
I'm right-handed.
Have you ever taught yourself to write with your left hand?
I haven't. I know of those interesting strategies and what have you, but I have never done that.
Oh, I've done that, and I can pretty much as easily write with my left hand as my right hand now, and drawing as well.
Uh-huh.
It's a very interesting experience.
I've noticed this in workshops because it's just popped into my mind. If 5% of the population or so is left-handed, which I think is the statistic, in creativity workshops, you're going to find 15 to 20% of the people who show up are left-handed. So I have no comment as to what that means. It's just an observation.
It's funny because I was talking to someone about that, and it sounds like because when it's the left hand that's non-dominant or undeveloped that way, that the expectations of that hand are less. And so it can actually be freer to create.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are things, as I say, I've never sort of followed up on or thought about, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting. Now, I read somewhere, I think this was on your website possibly, that you were a ghostwriter at one point?
I was. That's right. In my late 20s, I had a ghostwriting career, and there was a fellow who would funnel me bizarre projects. I would either take them on or not take them on if they were too bizarre, and I would write fiction. He would give me the name of a book and no other clue, and I would write a novel in a month's time, or he would give me a nonfiction idea, and I would write that book in a month's time. So, yeah, I had that career back in my early 20s.
So what do you think of ghostwriting?
There are many, many shadowy parts to it. It would be nice if we knew who was writing the books we read and if there was an opener, if it was more transparent.
Yeah.
Conversely, if you are trying to make a living as a writer, which is hard to do, and there is this avenue open to you, then it, you know, it makes sense to me that you're going to explore it and see if it isn't too shady.
So your experience was good with it?
It was half good. There were projects that seemed shady that I had to turn down, and then there came a moment where I did a book, and I presented a thesis in the book. I presented what I thought was, so to speak, the truth of the matter, and then the book came out with my thesis turned on its head, and then I stopped doing it. I saw that I couldn't control what was going to come out, and that I'd better just stop doing it.
Well, it sounds like you pay attention to your intuition. What would you recommend in terms of using intuition as a guide for a creative person?
Well, we have to be very mindful and watchful and intuitive. And I think we can often feel in our body, often as a tingle down our spine, when we're about to send our character off in the wrong direction, or send our novel off in the wrong direction, or send our symphony off in the wrong direction. So I think we want to be very, very mindful and also very aware of what our body is telling us in a given moment so that we don't have to undo things. Because if you send your character off in that wrong direction, 6 months later, you may have to spend another 6 months sending her right back, you know, where she ought to have gone. So once we realize how much time we can squander by not being aware of our strong intuitions, we want to stop doing that.
From reading your book, I would say that you see the art medium as a tool for growth and healing.
Absolutely. I think it's one of our primary meaning containers. That's the way I think of it. Since we are obliged to make our own meaning, we have to figure out what feels meaningful to us. And there are only a handful of things that feel genuinely meaningful to human beings, I believe. One are relationship kinds of things, being in love, being compassionate, taking care of people, being of service. And another is having the experience of manifesting our potential, having the experience of making use of those thoughts and feelings that are within us. So since that does feel meaningful to us, if we aren't doing it, we have the experience of meaninglessness and existential depression will follow, and it doesn't feel good. So it's important that we manifest our creativity for our own emotional life.
And quite often, a lot of that creative process is beyond words and even inaccessible for a while. Like with art therapy, as a painter, that can be like an art therapy where you're expressing unspoken energies through yourself, and it's only in looking at the finished piece that you can really translate it more easily to yourself and others.
Right.
Yeah.
And people want to know more than is appropriate. It's interesting to think about what this task of being creative really amounts to. One thing it amounts to is you're going through your whole day trying to know if you're supposed to be on the right side of the road, if your checkbook is balanced, where to pick up your kids. You're trying to do the right thing and, in fact, know what's going on. Then you're supposed to go to this place of real mystery and real not knowing and accept that you don't know the next stroke of your pen or the next stroke of your paintbrush. It's a very hard transition for most would-be creative people to move from the experience of knowing to the experience of not knowing. They come to the creative process thinking they're supposed to know there, too. And you're not supposed to know there. You're supposed to not know. You're supposed to be open to whatever wants to bubble up.
Yeah. Wow, you've described that very well. And you've used the word mystery a couple of times. And I think that mystery and the miraculous and sacred, these are terms that come up in your book. And that's a lot of what people are drawn to, isn't it?
I think so. I have no belief in religions and no belief in spirituality, and yet I believe in mystery and sacredness and words like that.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me there's no disjunction there. I don't think we know. That's why I think it's mysterious. And as soon as we claim to know, I think we begin to lie. I think there are big things we don't know.
Lie or deny.
Lie or deny. I think there are big things we don't know, like why the universe is here, etc. I think we don't know. And when we announce that we do know, I think we're doing something illegitimate. So I believe in real mystery, the kind of mystery where there aren't answers and where there never will be answers. And I think that's actually exciting rather than depressing or despairing.
Well, yeah, and again, it's a choice of perspective, isn't it?
That's right.
Now, you've mentioned here three creative elements, and this is quite powerful, I think, loving, knowing, and doing. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, I think I've said it in a variety of ways already. We don't have sufficient energy to get our creative work done if we aren't, in fact, in love with something. If our interest hasn't risen to a level almost of productive obsession, not unproductive obsession, but productive obsession, where we're really driven to think about it. So I think love is the fuel or energy that motivates our journey. And then over time, we have to know how to do the thing. It's amazing to me that someone would think that they would know how to do their first novel and be depressed or disappointed when they fail at their first novel. How would you know how to do your first novel except by doing it, making a hash of it, and then going on to your second novel? If you're very, very lucky, maybe your first novel will turn out. But it seems so much more logical and so much more truthful to imagine that the first novel is going to be your practice novel. And then you go on to your second novel. Most people can't think that way. They start bad-mouthing themselves and saying they have no talent or something when their first novel doesn't work. So knowing is that lifelong apprenticeship, that lifelong getting better at whatever it is you do. And then there is the constant doing. If you are just imagining that you're going to create or just spinning ideas in your head, that's a fantasy life that really doesn't serve you. And you have to turn that energy into something that actually gets done. So for me, those are the three component parts, loving, knowing, and doing.
Yeah, that sums it up nicely. And I think another indication of the act of creating is that sense of timelessness, where you just lose yourself.
Right. I call it the trance of working, and we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, the trance of working, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a kind of meditation, right?
Yes, it's an intentional meditation, though. It's a meditation for the sake of having something arise, which is different from many traditional meditation practices where your empty mind is supposed to stay empty. Here, you're emptying your mind for the sake of something arising. So although I entirely agree that it's a meditative state, it's slightly different from the mindfulness practice that somebody who's practicing meditation might be doing.
Now, you have a very interesting suggestion here. Where there's resistance in getting on with the work, you suggest to physically do the action of cracking an egg.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. First of all, I conceptualize resistance and blockage as two different things. Blockage
okay.
is about something, like the thing your clarinet teacher said to you 17 years ago that still hurts, or the fact that your in-laws are visiting, or something. You're blocked for some reason. Whereas resistance is just our everyday distance from the work. It's just how far we are from the work, and it feels like a sort of a thin veneer of something between us and the work. And so I was trying to think for a long time, what is the physical or analogous feeling to cracking through? And then it came to me that cracking an egg for no good reason feels the same way. If you crack an egg because you're baking a cake, you don't really experience anything. You just crack it and drop the egg into the bowl. But if you have to crack an egg for no good reason, all of us are a little squeamish. It just doesn't make sense. We don't want to do it. And there's something like that going on in our everyday resistance to creating. One of the first exercises I have my creativity coaches do, and often clients, is get a bowl and an egg and a spoon and bring that near your computer if you're a writer or near your easel if you're a painter, and crack an egg before you start. And just drop the egg and shells into the bowl and have the experience of cracking through resistance that way. And then the egg and the shells and the bowl serve a second purpose. So now you've cracked through resistance and you begin working and you enter into the trance of working. Then a point comes where maybe the cat jumps on you or a truck rumbles by or something and you come out of the trance of working. You get distracted. Most creative people or most people who are not quite effective enough as creative people will leave at that point. They'll say to themselves, well, I got some creating done. And because they're experiencing a little anxiety about starting all over again, they prefer to leave rather than stay put. So they only work for 45 minutes rather than the 2 or 3 hours that might be available to them. And what this egg now does is all you need to do is stir the egg and its shells in the bowl for 5, 10, 15 seconds, and that little bit of anxiety will reduce itself, and you'll be able to have a second creative stint that was not available to you if you just fled. So it's just a tactic or device to make real the idea of resistance and a way of overcoming resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you also have some visualization exercises, and you just reminded me there in your description of the idea of imagining a chasm and then drawing it to see how wide that chasm is and realizing that it could be just a very little chasm between...
Little width-wise, it doesn't matter if it's 15 miles deep, and I think it's the experience of that depth that scares, that's the not knowing, that's going into the darkness that scares people. So it doesn't matter how deep that chasm is, if you can visualize it as being very narrow and there being really no experience of risk or fear necessary because you can just step over it easily, that can help with the depth of it. Because the depth may remain just as deep. It may, in fact, remain very scary to go back into your past to think about your childhood as you work on your memoir. That may remain very scary, but this may be a way for you to make that movement into that scary place and past that scary place by just taking a small step.
Yeah, and it's important to acknowledge those places. It's a lot of what's going on beneath the surface and what needs to be resolved to build the foundation to build on, right?
Absolutely. And whether one uses a word like anxiety or fear, we have to figure out anxiety management tools for ourselves to work as creative people. We need our own good deep breathing exercises, our own good calming exercises, our own good ways of visualizing tranquility. We need to have some tactics at hand that allow us to reduce anxiety, because anxiety is always going to accompany us along this journey.
Yeah, and strategic time outs, like you suggest. Go for a walk, have a bath, but not in an avoidance way, but as a time out.
Time out, and also many of those are antidepressants, like a little bit of exercise or a little bit of sunlight works as an antidepressant. And as I wrote in the Van Gogh Blues, I think all creative people are going to experience enough bouts of depression that they better get a handle on it. Better understand to what extent it's existential depression much of the time, namely having the meaning leak out of the enterprise of what they're doing, suddenly not feeling like what they're doing matters enough. I think that's something all creative people experience, and the result of experiencing that is an existential depression. So we need tools for dealing with depression, and home remedies for depression are things like exercise and sunlight. So that's another reason to take that kind of time out.
I'm in conversation here with Eric Maisel, and his website is ericmaisel.com. You can also check out 10zenseconds.com. Tell us about the artist's 10 commandments.
Well, you would have to tell me what they are for me to tell you what they are, since I don't have them in front of me.
All right, I can do that. Oh, yes, I like these. Okay, so you suggest here in Creativity for Life, to reflect on these commandments as a way to integrate your thoughts about your personality, the creative work that you do, and your environment. So shall I just tell you what the 10 are?
Sure.
Look in the mirror.
That's being more truthful and mindful than we usually are, and that's being willing to understand our genuine situation and have the courage to face up what's really going on, because if we're not good reality testers, we'll live in a fantasy world. So that's what look in the mirror means. It's being willing to look at yourself.
And number 2 is look out the window.
It's similar. It's to understand what's really going on. If you don't understand the publishing marketplace, if you don't understand that speculative fiction is more in than science fiction at this split second, then you're going to make a mistake if you call the thing you're writing science fiction rather than speculative fiction. So it's you understanding what's actually going on out there around you.
Number 3, do the work.
We don't have to repeat that one.
No, you've got to do it. You can't just think about
it. Got to do the work.
Get off the couch. Number 4, see the synergies.
Well, there are places where all of the things that I'm talking about come together, where the anxieties and your own shadowy personality and the work, what have you, come together. One place where it comes together is if you have a conversation with a literary agent, for instance. That's where the marketplace and your own personality and the work you're doing come together. And that's why those kinds of moments are actually the most revealing. And so if you debrief yourself after the conversation you've had with a literary agent and try to see what went on, That's when you're going to get the most information about your creative life, is after those kinds of interactions.
Yeah, it's important to interact on those levels. Number five, explore your anxieties.
We've been talking about this a lot now, and that is to understand that you're not going to be able to do away with anxiety. For instance, choosing provokes anxiety. It just does. Having to make a choice provokes anxiety. We have to make one choice after another as a creative person. Then put the comma in, take the comma out, send our character to Zanzibar, send our character to Tanzania. These are all choices. And so since choosing provokes anxiety, we're always going to have some anxiety to deal with, and we have to understand that, embrace that, and figure out how to manage it.
Number six is become a master juggler.
Again, that pretty much goes without saying, except we really have to understand how much we're attempting to do, what we're trying to do in our creative life and in our parallel other life, how many different tasks are involved in getting a product both done and out into the world. There's just a lot going on, and it's too much really to hold in our head. We have to have our organizational strategies in place, maybe big whiteboards or software systems or something, where we understand what our next task is and what the task after that is, so we can keep these things straight.
Yeah, having a sort of an overview definitely helps. I find that listing and having a bigger visual as well at times.
Mm-hmm.
Number seven, practice existential magic.
We've talked about this too, and that's the idea that it is important to not go seeking after meaning, to not just receive meaning, but to understand that you have to make meaning in life. We all understand enough about our own cherished principles and what's required of us to then just go make the meaning that we intend to make. And that's what I mean by existential magic, is that we have the opportunity to make all the meaning that's required in our life.
That's good. Number eight is relate.
A lot of creative people, because being in solitude is often their preferred mode, forget that they also need some warmth in their life, some love, some human interaction. You don't want to be just in your studio all the time. That won't work over time. You'll just get too cold. So you want to remember to have human relationships.
Number nine, get a life.
Well, same yeah, thing.
Get a life.
Yeah, that's right. It's the same thing. It's that it just will not work to attempt to be that reclusive, busy, even successful creative person all the time. There are other things that are required, other meaning containers, other important aspects of life that we must pay attention to if we're actually going to experience life as successful.
And number 10 of the Artist's 10 Commandments in your book, Creativity for Life, is artfully adapt.
If you're a dancer who's 32, it's time to be looking at the next thing. Maybe you're a painter next. We're going to have to all make necessary transitions and adapt as the world changes, as a new piece of technology comes aboard. It's like being a visual artist and photography suddenly appears. Well, that affects what you're going to paint. It has affected what everybody's going to paint. So the universe changes and you change, and you need to continue adapting to these changes.
And as you say in your book, that lifelong creativity isn't just given to you. It is earned by attending to it daily. And further, that it's one thing to have a goal, but you need to have daily action in support of it.
Right.
Yeah. So what is your goal, Eric Maisel, with this book, Creativity for Life, putting this all together? It's an incredible amount of information.
Yeah, I just hope that creative people, you know, can get their hands on it and make use of it. There are lots of interesting things in there that you won't find in other places, things like how to actually create and maintain a creativity practice, and interesting stuff about artist relationships. I just hope that people will take a peek at it and make use of it.
Something that came to my attention recently about criticism, which is normally seen as something to shrink from, criticism is actually a gift because it gives us information.
It can. We have to be careful. We have to be able to sort out the part that isn't useful to us and the part that is useful to us. And I think that's another piece of our lifelong learning and lifelong apprenticeship, is to understand these refinements, to understand what in the criticism actually matters and what we should just slough right off.
It's good not to take things too personally.
Yes.
And consider the source and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I always like to ask my guests what living on purpose means to you, Eric.
Well, I think that's another way of saying what I've been saying. I think we're both saying the same thing. Living on purpose means identifying the principles you want to live by, and then living them.
Yeah, that's very succinct. Eric Maisel, it's been wonderful speaking with you. Thank you for being my guest on Living on Purpose.
No, thank you so much for having me.